The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, October 2019, Volume 20, Number 10, and this is the second of four installments. On this month's cover, Oprah wears a shimmery purple one-shoulder long-sleeved close-fitting sweater. Her left hand is raised to rest on her bare right shoulder, and a huge amethyst dinner ring matches the color of the sweater. Her hair is long, full, and wavy with subtle highlights. She smiles at the camera with her smoky eyes and soft caramel blush lipstick. This month's headline is What I Know for Sure: Healthy is the New Skinny. And let's start out this second installment with The World According to Gail. Under the headline Shop, Gail says, my favorite grand dog, Scott, is about to celebrate his first Halloween. Now, I never thought I'd be that guy, but in July, I was that guy when I sent favorite son, Will, that's him, holding Scott, and I'll describe that picture in a second, a list of doggy outfits from the family-owned Ruby's Costume Company, which makes just about every get-up you could imagine for furry friends. Will requested the businessman. I wanted the teddy bear, and Scott just went with the flow. I might be biased, but I think he's best in show. And so what we have here is a short hair breed of dog with kind of a teddy bear color, and the dark brown, almost black nose, and a little bit of shadowing around the eye, wearing a teddy bear costume with red gingham on the ears and a red gingham bow. Next up, we have Gail sitting in a diner booth with a young fella, and she says Ben Platt's performance in Dear Evan Hansen didn't just win him a Tony, it also caught the eye of Glee creator Ryan Murphy, who asked him to meet after seeing the musical. Ryan's pitch, the lead in The Politician, a sharp Netflix series about an ambitious yet very insecure high schooler, Peyton Hobart, who has one goal, become student body president. How did Ben, now 26, pull off playing a teen a full 3 years after originating the role of 17-year-old Evan? Easy, he told me. I ate like a bird and shaved my face. Ben, I mean Peyton, you've got my vote. And that was under the heading Stream, since that's available on Netflix. And now under Eat. I've often said I'd be fine if my last meal were a cheeseburger, but I would never have predicted that I'd enjoy a bacon cheeseburger dumpling. Brooklyn Chop House, described by restaurateur Stratus Morphigan as Chinese restaurant meets American steakhouse, showed me the light. Stratus believes anything in a sandwich can be turned into a dumpling. He's even experimenting with PB&J. I don't know about that, but I do know his cheeseburgery delights are juicy, tender, and a little bit of heaven. And next, applaud. Mariska Hargitay is a badass with a capital B. When the 21st season of NBC's Law & Order Special Victims Unit premieres on September 26th, her beloved Olivia Benson will become the longest-running female character in a primetime live-action series. From the beginning, Olivia's MO has always been to fight for women. As Mariska told me, quote, she embodies the criminal justice system as we wish it were, compassionate, unequivocally committed to righting wrongs, and fundamentally in the victim's corner, end of quote. Let's all take a page from that playbook. And under Watch, we have a picture here of Dolly Parton in a big blonde curly wig, bright red lipstick, and a shimmery dress with lots of colored fringe. It's white with lots of red and turquoise on it. Legendary filmmaker Ken Burns is a self-proclaimed child of rock and roll and R&B, but after 8 years researching all things country, he's now a fan of that uniquely American art form, too. Welcome to the club, Ken. His new 8-part PBS documentary, Country Music, educates and entertains with a down-home history of the industry, From the hillbilly music of the 1920s to the rise of superstar Garth Brooks, and interviews with everyone from Dolly Parton to Charley Pride. I've always believed country singers are some of the most considerate and talented entertainers out there. And come September 15th, I think you will too. And now let's look over at the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. And the first page is a full-page photograph, and it's two young girls, maybe early high school, possibly about tween age, and they are embracing with sort of anguished looks on their faces. And we have a quote from Lorraine Hansberry, author of A Raisin in the Sun. There is always something left to love. And in Live Your Best Life, what used to be the gratitude meter is now the high five, a whole handful of things to cheer about this month. And the first one is under the heading, Drawing Attention. Consider this new book, Your Personal Docent, Great Women Artists, with a line, a strikeout line, drawn through women, is a wide-ranging collection of exceptional work by women. It spotlights more than 400 old masters, modernists, and other talents from the past 500 years, from the instantly recognizable, like Georgia O'Keeffe, and this is her Jimson Weed, White Flower No. 1, shown here, to the unjustly unsung. Get the picture? And the next heading is Reading Rainbow. Gather round, children, for the most fabulous tale of all, Drag Queen Story Hour, held at libraries, schools, and bookstores around the world since 2015. In El Paso, Indianapolis, and more than 45 other cities, fierce performers read kids' books, both classic, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, and modern, Mary Had a Little Glam, to tots and their parents while spreading a message of tolerance, self-love, and glitter. To find or start a chapter near you, visit dragqueenstoryhour.org. And there is a picture of a drag queen. Now, you know that comes complete with way over-the-top eye makeup and false lashes. And a glittery silver top and a big curly blonde wig. The next heading, The More You Know. Any idea what distinguishes a castle from a palace, or denim from chambray, or jam from jelly? You can test your theories with What's the Difference, a weekly e-newsletter that breaks down the distinctions between closely related and commonly confused terms. Face the facts at whatsthediff.org. And there's a picture here of a castle with its turrets versus a palace with its palatial gardens. Next, Heart's Content. For 15 years, the New York Times Modern Love column has explored relationships of all stripes, romantic, platonic, familial, unrequited. On October 18th, eight of those real stories hit the small screen, brought to life by a cast including Anne Hathaway, Tina Fey, and John Slattery. In an eponymous new Amazon series, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll fall in you know what. And there's a picture here of John Slattery with his gray hair, very distinctive. You remember him from Mad Men, and Tina Fey, and they're sitting in a movie theater. He's holding a bucket of popcorn. She's leaning to the opposite side of her seat from him. So there's, even though they're sitting next to each other, there's quite a bit of space between them, and they're staring ahead at the movie screen with kind of downcast looks on their face. Finally, we've got a big, wet brown bear getting jiggly with it. For Bead Nose, Chunk, and more, and the more than 2,000 other brown bears in Alaska's Katmai National Park and Preserve. Size does matter. For the past 4 years, the park has hosted Fat Bear Week, a March Madness-style tournament in which 12 of its paunchiest residents are pitted against one another as fans vote for their favorite big boys and girls. To weigh in on this year's competition, which starts October 2nd, visit facebook.com catmainpp. And next up under Live Your Best Life is My Best Life, the celebrity version. And this is Kristen Bell, who plays hilariously flawed Eleanor Shellstrop in NBC's existential satire, The Good Place, which returned September 22nd for its final season, on what she can't live without. And Kristen is wearing this dark coral color classic blazer with the notched collar and a brown shirt underneath, and her blonde hair is parted in the middle and pulled back. She has this nice sort of that smoky eye, but with brown. And the first thing she says she can't live without is the tiny chef. He's a green stop-motion character on Instagram who cooks many plant-based dishes, many as in small, while singing popular music, but almost entirely in gibberish, which I think makes him universal. Next, a pillow from Jimmy Kimmel and his wife. It's embroidered with my tweet asking my husband, Dax Shepard, to marry me, as well as his tweet saying yes. We'd waited to get married because half our friends are gay, and we didn't think it was appropriate to have a wedding until they could too. The morning, DOMA, was squashed in the Supreme Court. I proposed on Twitter. Another thing she can't live without, croutons. Sometimes I buy them and sometimes I make my own. Just cut up a loaf of sourdough, add Lowry's seasoned salt and olive oil and bake. People forget about them, but not me, man. I would have croutons over any potato chip. The next thing she can't live without, senior rescue dogs. I'll scroll through Pet Finder for hours asking, are you my dog? Are you my dog? But my husband is allergic. When we met, I said, I can't not have dogs. He was like, I get it, but I can't breathe. Can you get a hypoallergenic one? Now we have 16-year-old Lola and one we recently adopted. She's named Taffy, but we call her Tiffany, or Trisket, or Biscuit, or Bob. And finally, one more thing Kristen can't do without, Michigan. Watching my children catch lightning bugs like I did as a kid and experiencing the state's sweltering humidity and mosquitoes on steroids, that helps the world make a bit more sense to me. And now, let's head over to Let's Eat, and this month's singular sensation is lobster. And set against a slightly pinkish background, we have pictures of claws and tails in a circle. Lobster roll season may be coming to a close, but our celebration of the succulent seafood is just getting started. And in a footnote, let the big one get away. Catches over 1.5 pounds can be difficult to cook evenly, so you risk tough meat in some spots. Lobster abounds in the Northeast from May through November, and we suggest elevating your fall entrees with its richness. The chewy delicacy is always delightful dipped in butter, but you can also use it to give grain-based meals like paella a meaty bite, or to sweeten pasta dishes, as in these scrumptious seasonal recipes from Half-Baked Harvest blogger Tegan Girard. Soft shell, recently molted lobsters typically have sweeter and more tender meat than their hard carapace counterparts. Speaking of shells, a sharp pair of kitchen shears is the best tool for removing them. A not too okay white is lobster's ideal wine match. A not too oaky white is lobster's ideal wine match. With rich dishes, uncork a fuller-bodied option like a Chenin Blanc, and with grilled or steamed recipes, try something lighter, maybe a Chablis. And then finally, good morning indeed. Add chunks of leftover lobster to your omelet, egg sandwich, or avocado toast. Now we've got two recipes. Brown butter lobster ravioli, and there's a picture of it here, and hand-thrown pottery dish with a kind of a white but very earthy glaze. The ravioli with a little bit of a pink sauce and a little bit of greenery sprinkled on it. This makes 8 servings for a total time of 1 hour and 30 minutes. In a large pot, bring salted water to a boil. Add 3 lobster tails, 6 to 7 ounces each, from 1 to 1.5 pound lobsters, and 1/4 pound uncooked shrimp, peeled and deveined, and cook until shells turn bright red and shrimp turn pink 5 to 8 minutes. Use tongs to remove, let cool, and extract lobster meat from shell. Finally, chop meat and shrimp. In a large skillet over medium heat, brown 1/2 cup, 1 stick of salted butter, stirring often until golden and toasted. Add 2 garlic cloves, minced or grated, and 1/2 teaspoon crushed red pepper flakes, and cook 1 more minute. Remove from heat and stir in lobster, shrimp, 1/4 cup parsley chopped, 1 teaspoon each of lemon juice and zest, and 1 pinch each of kosher salt and ground black pepper. Add 1 cup ricotta and stir to combine. Set filling aside. Roll 1 pound fresh pasta dough into lasagna sheets. Place 1 tablespoon blobs of filling 1 inch apart over 1/2 of 1 sheet. Brush water around filling, then fold sheet over fillings and press down to seal. Cut into squares. Keep ravioli covered as you work to prevent them from drying out. Repeat with remaining dough and filling. To make sauce, in a medium saucepan over medium heat, warm 2 tablespoons butter and 2 tablespoons of olive oil. Add 1/2 yellow onion, chopped, and cook until fragrant, about 5 minutes. Add 4 garlic cloves, minced or grated, and cook another minute. Stir in 1 28-ounce can crushed San Marzano tomatoes and season with salt and pepper. Cook over low heat, stirring occasionally until thickened slightly, 15 to 20 minutes. Stir in 1 cup whole milk, 1/4 cup grated Parmesan, 1/4 cup parsley, roughly chopped, and 1/4 cup basil, roughly chopped. Cook until warmed through about 10 minutes. Bring a large pot of salted water to a boil. In batches, boil ravioli until they float 1 to 2 minutes. Drain, divide among bowls, and spoon tomato sauce over top. The next recipe, here's a footnote about the ravioli. Good to know. You can freeze your ravioli for another night's dinner. Once they're assembled, arrange in a single layer on a parchment-lined baking sheet, cover, and place in the freezer for 1 to 2 hours before transferring to a freezer bag. They'll stay fresh for up to 4 months. When the time comes, drop frozen ravioli into boiling water and add 1 to 2 minutes of cooking time. And now the next recipe, skillet grilled seafood and chorizo paella. This makes 6 servings for a total time of 55 minutes. Preheat grill to high heat. Place a large, at least 12-inch, cast iron skillet on grill grates. Once hot, add 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1/2 cup of sweet onion chopped, and 2 garlic cloves minced. Season slightly with kosher salt and ground black pepper and cook, stirring often, until onion is soft, 3 to 5 minutes. Add 4 ounces Spanish chorizo, sliced, and cook until just brown, 2 to 3 minutes. Add 4 heirloom tomatoes, chopped, or 1 14-ounce can whole peeled San Marzano tomatoes, crushed with your hands, plus their juices, and 1 8-ounce jar roasted red peppers, sliced. Cook for 5 minutes. Add 1/4 cup white wine to deglaze skillet, then stir in 2 cups jasmine or basmati rice. Cook until toasted, 3 to 5 minutes. Slowly pour in 4 cups chicken broth and stir. Add 2 small skinless chicken thighs or breasts, 1/3 cup blue cheese stuffed green olives, 1 teaspoon smoked paprika, 1 pinch of salt and pepper, and 1 generous pinch of saffron. Stir gently to combine. Then cover tightly with skillet lid or foil. Close grill and cook for 15 minutes. Meanwhile, toss 1 lobster tail, 6 jumbo shrimp, 6 clams, and 6 mussels with olive oil, and sprinkle with salt and pepper. Add seafood to skillet, replace lid or foil, close grill, and continue cooking until seafood is cooked through and rice is fluffy, about 15 minutes. Remove skillet from grill and drizzle with juice of 2 lemons. Season lightly with salt and pepper, garnish with parsley, and serve family style. Each month, a different person is featured in the Where Are You Going? And there is a 2-page photo, and this has 3 women on bicycles in the foreground, and they are cycling against the Painted Hills Scenic Bikeway in Mitchell, Oregon. And this is a much more desert-like and arid than I generally think of Oregon being. The hills in the distance have just a few scrubby trees on them, and the middle ground is like the Painted Desert. Molly Sugar, cyclist. On the Painted Hills Scenic Bikeway, Mitchell, Oregon. Molly says, I moved from Brooklyn to Portland, Oregon in 2016. Portland appealed to me because of its solid creative community and easy access to nature. I'd been a bike commuter in New York City, and I took that to the extreme for my move. I rode across the country to my new home, and that 2.5-month trip cycling was no longer something I did just for transportation or fun. It was my passion. It has also introduced me to so many of my friends. I met Jay when I took my bike for a tune-up to the shop where she worked and brought me closer to others like Janae. But as much as I love cycling, I've been disappointed by how white and male-dominated it can be, especially in Portland. So in 2017, I started a group called Friends on Bikes, which gathers women of color for local events and overnight trips. We break down barriers to entry by providing gear to those who need it to make sure everyone who's curious about the sport has a chance to develop the same love we have. Next up, I'm doing a 3-month, 2,700-mile ride with my fiancé. The route takes us from the Canadian border all the way to Mexico. We'll carry our house on our bikes, so to speak, tent, sleeping bag, cooking supplies. Of course, long-distance cycling can be tough. You fall in the middle of nowhere, a chain slips, a tire goes flat. But it doesn't have to be complicated. You just take what you need and leave the rest behind. Let's look at a few items from Love That. And on the very first page, we have Back in the Saddle. And our model, who with her long brunette, silky, shiny, wavy hair touching just below her shoulders, is wearing kind of an ivory, almost peasant style, thin gauzy blouse with some brown trousers. And she's got a couple of saddlebags draped across her shoulders, and then she's holding one. Back in the saddle, it says, champing at the bit for a new carryall, the iconic equestrian-inspired bag of the 70s is back. Unfussy, yet fashionable. It scores big for being super practical, swiftly slung crossbody so your hands are free to access the flap front. With a signature D shape and in grab-and-go sizes, great for every day. The latest takes in luxurious shades will keep you riding in style. And the one worn as a crossbody bag is slightly rounded, and it's in a really nice soft blush pink. And it has both the smooth leather side as well as the brushed leather side. And it has a little bit of detail. This is a very polished bag. Another bag, this one is larger and more rectangular and is in a deep brown that kind of goes to an olive green. It's got a couple of buckles on the 1.5-inch wide strap and a little bit of rope detail that kind of circles the bottom of the bag. And then finally, there is your classic burgundy leather. And the flap is only about 2/3 way down the front and has a neat X cross design on it, and it has a lot of top stitching and a lot of detail work on the strap. The bags are from Kiana for $325, Jenny Kane for $695, and Weldon at $395. And now let's look at Adam's style sheet. Good news, fleece fans, your favorite fluffy pullover has taken a fashion-forward turn. Creative director Adam Glassman shows you a few elevated ways to warm the trend. And the inspiration comes from the Coach Fall 2019 runway look with this big, oversized, color-blocked fleece jacket, which is worn over a short, sheer black knife pleat skirt with black ankle boots. So we have three styles here. Dress the part, add some edge, and keep it classic. Dressing the part, we top off a tan corduroy skirt with a fleece from L.L. Bean, and it is Southwest inspired. It's in shades of brown, ivory, teddy bear brown, and cool blue with an oversized Southwest design on it. The ankle boot is in a rich tan leather with a skinny 3/4 inch strap that kind of wraps around the ankle, and it's got a tall, chunky wooden heel. And they show it here with a smooth tan leather bucket bag. The fleece is $109 from L.L. Bean. The dress, actually, that it's worn over, not the skirt, is $80 from Gap. The bucket bag is from Hobo, and it's $318. And the booty is from Vince Camuto, and it's $159. The next look is where we add some edge to the fleece, and over some black slacks, we have a color-blocked fleece that is a leopard print with a black yoke and a red flap over the left breast, and a little brass zipper from the stand-up collar down through the black yoke that ends just above the breast line. Pair a leopard version with a tie waist leather trouser, and that makes a luxe statement. The fleece is $395 from veronicabeard.com. The vegan leather pants are from White House Black Market, and they're $99. This is shown with a gray backpack from Vera Bradley, and it's $195. And it has that diamond pattern embroidered on half of the front, which is a separate zip pocket. And then finally, there's a white sneaker with a big black band that goes across the arch of the foot, and it's from Vionic, and it's $140. Now, keeping it classic, we have a classic kind of large-scale gray and black Glen plaid tailored jacket with the notch collar, flap pockets, and one single black button over a pair of slightly flare-legged jeans that have a little bit of a wear pattern over the knees and on the crease. And this is worn over a kind of lightweight gray fleece with a little bit of pink detailing on the snap enclosure and a little pink piping around the stand-up neck. And it's worn with a peachy pink chunky heeled pump. Unexpected laid-back polish, Adam says, a snap-up style layered fleece under a blazer. The fleece is $89 from Patagonia. The blazer is $445 from us.maje.com. The jeans are $225 at 7forallmankind.com. The heel is from Margot, and it's $245. And finally, there is a cross body saddlebag in black with kind of a pale pink top stitching, and that is $465 from Brahmin. And across the bottom of the page, cozy time. Get your feet in on the action with Snuggly Boots, Slides, and more. We have some your classic two-strap Birkenstock with the sole and the lining of the straps in a white fleece. They're $150. We have a Mark Fisher ankle boot with a low but wide chunky heel in a light tan suede. It's $210. Keds has a fleece slip-on in a brown and ivory color with some brown piping, and that's $60. UGG has a lace-up ankle sneaker for $150, big white sole. And then finally from Ross & Snow, a brown fleece slide for $225. And now let's head over to Beautiful for the Fall Beauty Awards 2019. And we'll divide this up across a couple of installments. And the first page of Beautiful this month shows just about every shade of foundation, and they have been splatted out and brushed out to look like a starburst. So we have the rich chocolates down to the ivories. Guerlain L'Essentiel Foundation is what they're showing here in 30 shades, $60 each at shop.nordstrom.com. And it's a beautiful clear glass bottle that's almost like an orb. And the top is kind of a brass orb itself, but it sits slightly askew, not directly on the top, but just slightly at an angle. El Sherm Beauty Intern says, far from cakey, this full coverage base is buildable and lasts throughout the day and well into the evening. Although it's somewhat perfumey at first, the scent fades once you buff the product into your skin. You, whose bathroom drawers are stocked with creams that just haven't delivered. You, with 63 shades of red lipstick that aren't quite the one. And you, with the hair that's bouncy when you walk out the door and on life support by lunch. We take your beauty issues seriously, so seriously that our entire staff, plus some Intrepido magazine insiders, swiped, smeared, and lathered their way through hundreds of the season's new products to find the stars that are worth the investment. Whether you're looking to lift, lighten tone, tighten, defrizz, depuff, smooth, or soften, check out our frank feedback on the following pages. I know you'll find your next must-have product right here. Brian Underwood, Beauty Director. And when we turn the page, we have stacked up cylinders of CoverGirl True Blend Undercover Concealer. And they have these snazzy white cylinder tops with black rings on them. Forget the big city. The hottest real estate market is the limited space inside your makeup bags. Consider clearing some room for these standouts. The first, CoverGirl True Blend Undercover Concealer. It's in 30 shades, $11 each, at drugstores. Brian says, yes, guys use concealer too, and this one masked my dark circles expertly. The Doe Foot applicator makes it easy to dot the product on your skin. A little goes a long way. Just make sure to prep with eye cream so it doesn't settle into any fine lines. The second of the Fall Beauty Awards goes to Rodin Oleo Lusso Luxury Lip and Cheek Oil. 5 shades, $35 each. Jessica Taylor, OMAG Insider, says, on my lips, this is nourishing and comfortable. The color is subtle enough to wear with any outfit or other makeup, which I like. On my cheeks, it works beautifully for just a hint of color when I'm sporting an otherwise bare face. The third item, Beauty Blender, the Detailer's Brush Collection, $22 to $60 each at beautyblender.com. Alexandra Mooney, art director, says, I love these brushes so much, and the best part is the silver massage ball on the end of the handle. Heaven for tired, puffy eyes. Number 4 out of 10, Dior Rouge Dior Ultra Care. 21 shades, $30 each at Dior.com. Erin Stovall, associate beauty editor, says, you no longer have to choose between lipstick and lip balm. This gave me a pop of color and hydration. A bonus, it had the loveliest floral scent, courtesy of natural botanical oils. 5th out of 10, Givenchy Volume Disturbia Mascara, $27 at Sephora. Erin says, this went on smoothly and my lashes looked long, separated, and voluminous. It lasted all day without smudging, and another plus, the tube is so luxe. Fabulous. Number 6, Maybelline New York Tattoo Studio Liquid Ink Liner, $8 at drugstores. Adrian Gerard, copy chief, says, the ultra-fine tip makes precise application a breeze. I could get it into the lash line without pressing too hard, as I sometimes have to when I use a pencil. It dried quickly, so I was able to do the rest of my eye makeup without smearing, and it didn't budge from 9 to 5. Number 7, La Mer The Hydrating Illuminator, $75. Deborah Way, deputy editor, says, luscious but light, it left my cheekbones such as they are with a subtle but flattering glow. Number 8, Clé de Peau Beauté Radiant Liquid Rouge, 18 shades, $50 each. Holly Carter, Style Features Director, says, highly pigmented and rich, this product is a nice midpoint between a gloss and a lipstick. The shine formula is hydrating without feeling too tacky, and the applicator practically glides over your lips. Number 9, Sisley Paris Phyto Ombre Eyeshadow Collection, 20 shades, $54 each. Erin says, buttery soft pigments, buildable coverage, zero fall off. What's not to love? The glow gold shade has become my new go-to. I just quickly sweep it over my entire lid to create a gorgeous, ethereal sheen. And finally, number 10, Glossier Brow Flick. 3 shades, $18. Allison Chin, visual editor, says, I like the flexible tip, and the sheerness made my brows look fuller and darker with no harsh lines. It stayed on throughout the day, even through some errand-induced sweat. Let's now look at a special feature this month called The Agony and Yes, the Ecstasy of Menopause, a different kind of coming-of-age story. When I was 48, I joined a new book club. At my first meeting, talk turned to an ex-member who'd been having a hard time with hot flashes. One evening, the women said things got especially bad for her. She shifted uncomfortably all through the book talk until finally she had to peel off her sweater for relief. When that wasn't enough, she tore off her blouse. When that wasn't enough, off came her tank top, too, until she sat there red-faced and dripping in just her bra. Back then, the prospect of hot flashes terrified me. My mother's had been ferocious. If you haven't reached menopause yet, you might be terrified too, and not just by the idea of turning into the incredible flaming woman stripped to her skivvies in someone else's living room. There are the hot flashes, the night sweats, the brain fog, the mood swings, the free-range rage, the bloating, the weight gain. And on top of those miseries is the loss they're supposed to portend of sexiness, of fertility, of the best and juiciest part of your life, of femininity, of, if you take it far enough, your very womanness. You will become shriveled and uninteresting, the story goes, a dried-up, barren husk of your former self, an old hag that no one lusts after anymore, and then you'll die. Here's the truth. You probably will sweat the physical stuff and possibly the mood stuff, maybe a lot, perhaps a ton. You will likely, sometimes astonishingly, encounter bodily changes no one ever told you. You might be frustrated and, yes, enraged by modern medicine's incomplete understanding of what is happening to you and by the cultural sexism that underlies that failure. But you may also make a significant discovery, something grand and important. You might even call it the discovery of a lifetime. That menopause, far from being the tragic end of the best part of a woman's existence, can actually be a threshold, a gateway, the passage to the you you've been waiting your whole life to become. Beginning with the first period at about age 12, to be female is to experience a decades-long cycle in which two powerful sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone, rise and fall, triggering the rhythms of menstruation. Estrogen, secreted by the ovaries as an egg matures, reaches its highest level during week 2 of a typical 4-week cycle. Progesterone, secreted after the egg follicle ruptures during ovulation, peaks between weeks 3 and 4. These two hormones are primarily responsible for getting a woman's body ready month after month to achieve and maintain a pregnancy. As the ovaries age in the 4 to 10 year lead up to menopause known as perimenopause, which usually begins in the mid to late 40s, they don't reliably release an egg every month, and whenever a cycle takes place without ovulation, there's no empty egg follicle and no progesterone is produced. So that month, there's an imbalance, too much estrogen, too little progesterone, and maybe the same is true 2 months later when again there's no ovulation, and a month or two after that. It can all lead to roiling hormonal swings that are a lot like puberty, except worse, because these inner storms happen while you're up to your eyeballs in the trappings of responsible adulthood. Joanne Pinkerton, MD, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Virginia and executive director emeritus of the North American Menopause Society, says, quote, "My perimenopausal patients are in the middle of very busy lives," end of quote. They're juggling their jobs and might be at the height of their careers or trying to reboot after being downsized or stressing over ageism in the workplace. Their kids, who might be hormonally charged teens themselves, their aging parents with their increasing care needs, their other health issues, which can include chronic conditions like hypertension, arthritis, and diabetes, and their love lives, which can be affected by all manner of factors, from divorce to romantic malaise to partners facing health issues of their own. Pinkerton says, quote, "All of these make the process of perimenopause much more difficult even than puberty was," end of quote. Yet when it comes to navigating that process, women are to a stunning degree left to their own devices. Stephanie S. Fobian, MD, medical director of the North American Menopause Society, or NAMS, and director of the Mayo Clinic Center for Women's Health, says, quote, "Every girl gets the period talk, but almost no woman gets a talk about what's happening on the other end. That's really a shame, and as a result, we have women coming to the clinic in a panic. They can't sleep. They're having heart palpitations. They're forgetting things. Their hair is thinning. They're anxious, and they literally think they're dying when, in fact, they're just in perimenopause," end of quote. If there were such a thing as the menopause talk, it would make sense for doctors to initiate it. But by and large, medical training doesn't equip them to do so. In a 2019 study in which researchers surveyed 177 residents in family medicine, internal medicine, and OBGYN, 20% received zero menopause lectures during their residency. Less than 7% said they felt prepared to manage the care of women in the various stages of menopause. The knowledge gap reflected in those numbers may explain why, in another survey, only 7% of midlife women with urogenital changes, like vaginal dryness, pain during sex, urinary incontinence, said they had doctors who broached the subject of such changes with them. Instead, many women complain of doctors who minimize their concerns with essentially a pat on the head and a shrug of the shoulders and a reminder that menopause is just part of life. You could argue that that attitude represents progress. In her new book, The Slow Moon Climbs, The Science, History, and Meaning of Menopause, Susan Mattern, a professor of history at the University of Georgia, notes that the author of the first American textbook on menopause from 1897 compared its effects to epilepsy, hysterical attacks, and the paroxysms of malaria. Thus began a trend of pathologizing a natural phenomenon experienced by half the human population. With the advent of hormone therapy, pioneered in the 1930s, first available in the U.S. in 1942, the trend became the rule. In the 1950s, a decade that loved its gender norms, the femininity fearmongers joined in, beating the drum of diminished sexuality and youthfulness. And in 1966, a Brooklyn gynecologist named Robert Wilson published a runaway bestseller, Feminine Forever, whose sexist attitudes linger today. Wilson was the Pied Piper of plying menopausal women with estrogen for the rest of their lives. With estrogen, he promised, they could look forward to eternal youth and attractiveness and menstruation. On Wilson's plan, women could expect to have 5 to 7 periods per year indefinitely. Without estrogen, they were fated to live as sexual neuters, suffering from a serious, painful, and often crippling disease that made long life an unnatural burden. Wilson wasn't speaking metaphorically when he said menopause could and should be cured. We surely don't want to go back to that kind of thinking, but as we make our way through perimenopause and menopause, we deserve to be able to function in our lives and in the world comfortably and with dignity. That menopause isn't something to be cured shouldn't mean our only option is to grin and bear it, or gin and tonic and bear it while standing in front of an open freezer fanning ourselves. We aren't asked to do so with menstrual cramps or childbirth, other natural processes. Men aren't asked to do so with erectile dysfunction. ED, by the way, is the male equivalent of hot flashes in the sense that each is the most problematic symptom of the decline of a signature hormone. Yet, as Amy M. Miller, PhD, President and CEO of the Society for Women's Health Research, notes with some frustration, at this point, treating ED is so commonplace it can be done with generic drugs. In the pecking order of American society, men still outrank women, and menopausal women often seem hardly to rank at all, not just in the media or in Hollywood or on Tinder, but in all the places where we tend to become invisible as we age, and in biomedical research, which for years has left midlife women in the lurch. Happily, that's changing, though you're still likely to kill a conversation by making mention of your hot flashes. You may not be embarrassed, but other people will be on your behalf. The menopausal transition is coming out of the shadows. Someday, we may look back on 2019 as the year Darcy Stanke invented a new publishing category, the Menopause Tell-All, with her Flash Count Diary, Menopause, and the Vindication of Natural Life. Certainly it should go down in history as the year the Emmy-nominated dramedy Fleabag featured Kristen Scott Thomas having a soliloquy majestically about the menopause. The fucking menopause. More on this later. And let's not forget that in the UK, the University of Leicester has adopted an official, first-of-its-kind menopause policy designed to normalize the experience, inviting the women and men of its faculty and staff to monthly menopause cafes and exhorting them simply to speak the word menopause 3 times daily. Want to try this yourself? You might start on October 18th, World Menopause Day. As more women assume leadership roles in science and medicine, we're also seeing new data about what happens in our 40s and 50s. and using more dignified terminology to discuss it. In 2014, for instance, the condition crushingly known as vaginal atrophy was renamed genitourinary syndrome of menopause. One major source of this data is the study of women across the nation, SWAN, now in its 23rd year. SWAN's origin story is instructive. Back in the 1990s, Sherry Sherman, an endocrinologist with the National Institute on Aging, then in her 40s, suspected a serious lack of scientific knowledge about midlife women. Susan Johnson, an emerita professor of OBGYN and epidemiology at the University of Iowa and SWAN's current study chair, says, quote, "She was determined to do something about it," end of quote. So Sherman organized a conference at the National Institutes of Health to gather what was understood about menopause at the time. It confirmed that the pool of knowledge was shallow indeed, at which point Sherman went out and secured funding to sponsor a network of 7 clinical sites to start collecting data from thousands of women then aged 42 to 52. The study has generated a slew of reports, close to 500 journal articles to date, that reveals menopause to be normal, natural, sometimes difficult, but eminently survivable. It was SWAN that really focused new attention on perimenopause, helping establish it as a pivotal point when a woman's lifestyle choices can have a profound effect on her future health. Sherman died in 2014, but SWAN, her legacy, is potent proof of what scientific research can achieve when the people asking and answering the questions are women, as 7 of SWAN's 10 principal investigators are. That same lesson was borne out by a groundbreaking 2016 study from Johns Hopkins, the work of 2 female Hopkins OBGYNs, Wen Shin, MD, and Mindy Christensen, MD, who a few years earlier had surveyed hundreds of OBGYN residents across the U.S. to see whether they'd had adequate instruction on menopause. And finding that they hadn't, devised a 2-year menopause medicine curriculum to see if it made a difference. Did it ever? Before the curriculum, 76% of residents felt barely comfortable managing the care of menopause patients. 8.4% felt not at all comfortable. After the curriculum, the cohort of comfortable/very comfortable had swelled to 86%. Wen and Christensen are now menopause education evangelists. They've put their lectures on CDs that they send free to other OBGYN programs, and Wen has even developed an app to answer practitioners' treatment questions. NAMES has similarly invested in boosting practitioner know-how by offering a certification program in menopausal health. Any licensed healthcare provider, physician, nurse, naturopath, physician's assistant, pharmacist, social worker, psychologist can sit for the exam, which consists of 100 multiple choice questions that test knowledge on everything from hypothalamic, pituitary, ovarian axis to bone mineral density tests to the use of isoflavones and herbs as alternative therapies. Currently, 1,131 practitioners are certified. The NAMS website, menopause.org, is a handy tool to help you find one near you. I could have benefited from seeing such a practitioner myself. Like many women, I was surprised to find that as my ovaries wound down, my periods aggressively ramped up. I bled like crazy, heavily, unpredictably, sometimes just like a vampire cleanse. I went to business meetings, dinners, movies, massively pre-padded. The only thing that stanched the flow was going back on the birth control pill in my late 40s, a treatment not without risks, but risks I was willing to take. I never did get the hot flashes that plagued my mother. It turns out that your menopause doesn't necessarily mimic your mother's, nor does it have any obvious connection to your own reproductive history, whether you had easy pregnancies, tough ones, or none at all. Scientists do know that women who've ever suffered a major depressive episode have a 59% greater chance of experiencing another one in perimenopause. They've also found suggestive links between childhood trauma and the severity of menopause symptoms, and there are hints that women who had PMS will experience more mood issues. But experts are still teasing out all these relationships, which are multi-layered and complex. In my early 50s, I went off the pill to see if things had settled down, and they had. Eventually, after a year without bleeding, I was diagnosed as having gone through menopause. I was done, and that was a relief. I was glad to say goodbye, glad to be liberated from the emergency fortifications I'd grown used to carting around, glad to no longer be ruled by a cycle and instead be able to focus on myself and my own idiosyncratically shifting needs. A lot of work goes into being a woman of childbearing age. Mine was finished, and I'd had it relatively easy. My husband had a vasectomy when we were in our 30s, so I'd already enjoyed years of not needing to give one single thought to birth control. Plus, I'd never faced the risks that fertility brings for women and girls in so many parts of the world. For me, a lucky middle-class American, getting to menopause was a new kind of freedom. For other women, it is salvation. I did wonder, though, what's the point of menopause in evolutionary terms? What's the advantage of a trait that makes reproduction impossible? In almost every other animal species, females can bear young until nearly their dying day, yet women lose that ability and then go on to live another third of their life. Paleoanthropologists have suggested that far from being merely an aberration among humans, menopause is what made us human. The so-called grandmother hypothesis, which gained traction in the 1990s, thanks to field data gathered by anthropologist Kristen Hawkes of the University of Utah, posits that menopause gave our forebears the chance to evolve some of our most salient beneficial traits. As the theory goes, early humans lived in multi-generation kinship groups, and the postmenopausal women in these groups, lacking young children of their own, played a critical role in aiding the survival of their offspring's children, who, living to adulthood, were able to procreate and pass on their grandmother's longevity genes. This, in turn, allowed for the evolution of more complex brains and the development of cooperation and sociability. Nicely done, cave ladies. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.